Accession number 30419, reel 13.
Yes, I was just wondering about things like food and water and rations. What were you eating on the base?
Yes, we...
Apart from your extraordinary Chinese meals.
Not a lot of water, as far as I remember. Well, I suppose we must have drunk water, but we didn't half drink a lot of tiger beer. It came in pint glass, pint mugs, and on draft, and it's a lager beer. Very strong. I 4.5 or something like that percent. And... we used to drink it like water, and it became a kind of a test of manly strength that you could hold your tiger beer. When I first arrived, and was driven from the airport to Temple Hill officers' mess, went into the bar. There's a guy sitting there that I happened to know, and he was drinking half a pint of tiger beer out of a pint mug, and that's the way the barman served it to him, because he was shaking so much that he couldn't hold the beer in a pint mug. So he used to get halves in a pint mug, and the bloke said to me, "That's one of your predecessors. He's been here 3 years and he got the DTs. He'd become almost alcoholic, so you had to actually watch it a bit. You could drink too much." A lot of people did drink too much. I drank too much. When I went out, I was 14 stone. Within a year, I was 16 and far too heavy. And so you did drink a lot. Now, that was two reasons. Number one, it was bloody hot. You had to drink a lot. Number three, I suppose, there was a social reason to show you could do it, peer pressure. But then there was the release from tension, because we did do an awful lot of flying in extremely dangerous conditions, and so it was the classic military man's relief from tension. The food, well, the food at the Chinese stalls was indescribably good. You can still get it in Singapore. They've kept one small area for outdoor eating stalls, and it's always hugely crowded. You get a series of them set up, not all run by Chinese. There's some Indians as well, but I don't think the Malays do it. It's very much a Chinese thing, and you have everything from fresh crabs slaughtered at your table, as it were, through all the noodles you could want, stir-fried vegetables. I remember when I came back from Singapore, my aunt asked me to take her to a Chinese restaurant, because you must know all about Chinese food by now. But of course, the Chinese food in a Chinese restaurant here is nothing like the Chinese food you get in China. But it's also wonderfully fresh and piping hot because it's done in the wok. Just indescribably good. And we, after dinner in the mess, which usually comprised English dishes, you ate a la England. There was always a Chinese option, though. But after dinner in the mess, you usually went down to top up in Changi Village with Chinese food. It was wonderful.
So what kind of English dishes were you being served? It must have been quite a contrast.
Steak and pie and roast beef and sausages and all sorts, you know, the usual stuff. There was a formal dining in night once a month, as there always is in the Air Force, and that would be invariably English food with meat and three veg. Brown Windsor soup.
What's brown Windsor soup?
Brown Windsor soup, or mulligatawny maybe, but it was fine. It was terrific food. We had no complaints. Breakfasts were great. You could have the RAF breakfasts have always been great in my experience. The one at the RAF Club still is in London. So you could get everything you wanted in the breakfast time, which would be early because you had to get to the squadron by 8 o'clock.
So it would be a big fry-up? Or
you could have a fry-up in the morning, yeah. And I expect I usually did. I do, though, have a memory of the mess at Kuching, which is later on in Borneo, where you got poached eggs. And I can every time we have poached eggs every Thursday morning, Kathy, and I always think of the mess at Kuching. But they tasted extraordinary because eggs taste of what the chickens eat. And goodness knows what they ate in Kuching. A lot of garlic. Well, those eggs were wonderful. They were beautiful poached eggs. The guy could do it in a saucepan. You know, they were beautiful. We ate... every Sunday there was a curry in the mess. If we were there on Sundays, quite often we were away on route or on detachment. But if you were there, you tried to catch the Sunday curry. But that meant cutting short your drinking in the bar. And so I can remember quite often we were still in the bar when they stopped serving in the mess. So then what we would do is we would go and get a curry from Changi Village, which comprised a meat or vegetable curry of various strengths, which was put into a condensed milk tin, empty of condensed milk, I hasten to say, but with the lid still on, and pulled up with a little hole put through it and a piece of string so you could carry it.
So that was the takeaway?
That was the takeaway. Takeaway in a condensed milk tin. And then you got your chapati or your rice in a banana leaf. Wrapped up in a banana leaf. Beautifully done, tied with a little bit of raffia. And you took that away and made friends with it somewhere. Usually you went to John Horsfall's house. He lived with his wife Jill in a hiring just off the end of the runway, just below Changi Jail, and where he would supply the tiger beer and the darts, and we would bring our takeaway curries. And that's the way the rest of the Sunday was spent, until the bar opened and we all went back to the bar. And then perhaps down to Changi Village for another meal at Mr. Lim's stall. We ate and ate and ate and ate. And as I say, I got very large and so did a lot of people.
And how about sanitation? That was my other question.
Oh,
washing conditions.
I mean, absolutely top class. The drainage systems were at Changi were terrific. Not so much downtown, but we... I mean, got a bit, as I say, Changi River was an open sewer, Singapore River was an open sewer, but the British knew about their plumbing. And so in the Basha huts, we had bathrooms, bath facilities. The Basha huts had 1, 2, 3 rooms, I think, and then the bathrooms and washing facilities and toilets, and then another 3 rooms the other side, and a long veranda. And there were drained, monsoon drains. You had to watch out for snakes.
In the drains?
In the drains, yes. But there were lots of snakes around. You got used to that. I think there were 40 kinds of snakes on Singapore Island. All of them wonderful. Very friendly things, snakes.
Really?
Yeah, they're not aggressive unless you tread on them. So the trick is not to tread on them. And monkeys, yeah, the monkeys were a bit of a nuisance. They used to pinch things and make a hell of a rattling noise. They're very sexually aggressive monkeys, and when they're on the roof, you know all about it.
What would they pinch?
They pinch anything they could find, and you fortunately you had mosquito netting on the windows, so. That was usually kept, but if you left the door open, they'd be in and take away anything bright, cufflinks and from the necklaces from the girls and that kind of thing. And food, if you left any food out, they would immediately, they reckon it was left out for them. I had a fish tank. I set up a fish tank in my room I used to keep tropical fish at home, and it was such a wonderful novelty not to have to have any heating system, because the water was the right temperature for them. And the monkeys, I used to have to keep the cover on the fish tank, or the monkeys would have had that. The other thing that I remember very much was the geckos, the small lizards which could climb up the walls and over the ceilings. And every room had a gecko in it, which you welcomed. They called chit-chats because they make that noise, chit-chat, chit-chat. They were welcomed because they would catch insects. And you had to watch out for the mosquitoes.
Were the mosquitoes a problem?
Not in Changi, because the drainage was so good. The mosquitoes would breed in stagnant water, and they made sure there wasn't any stagnant water at Changi. They would still bite, but they would still get mosquito bites in various parts, or down in Changi village, or out on the more swampy bits of the airfield. And if you were susceptible, you still got bitten. But they weren't such a problem. Different in Borneo. So the chit-chats were welcomed. We used to play squash. There were squash courts on the hill. Temple Hill was a hill, I mean, obviously. And there was a road that drove up round it, past the mess and back down again. And all the huts were below that road. And one of the buildings was a squash court. I used to play squash, which was pretty weakening. I mean, you used to wear yourself out in that temperature, and then go and drink too much beer and put so all the weight you'd lost in the squash court, you went and put on back in the bar. When we were night flying, and we did quite a lot of night flying training. When we got back to the bar, flying suits were not allowed in the mess. And so we still had our flying suits on. We used to put them on, leave them on. I suppose night flying detail, you got collected from the mess. I can't think why we were still in flying suits, but we were. So we were able to climb outside the veranda along above the monsoon drain and get our beer there, which our mates would hand over to us from the bar. And that led to quite a party or two, especially later on in the 3 years when we used to get we were getting a bit combat fatigued and needed more and more relief from the alcohol. But when we were still civilized, we used to also go down to the officers' club where there were dances. And at Christmas time there was a party, and it was great fun. There was a lovely combo. We used to play music and we used to dance. There were dances in the mess. There was a lovely one in autumn when we all wore our shark skin suits for jackets for the first time, and of course we all had the girlfriends came from the daughters of more senior officers. One of my chums, Pat Gorman, squired the daughter of the Air Marshal Admin all the time he was there. The teachers, my friend Barry Priest, whom you will probably meet, he married a teacher. They had a block along not too far away from ours. And I don't think there were any WAF officers married. Oh yes, there was. I think my girlfriend at the end married a naval officer. A buccaneer pilot. So that's where the girls came from. That was the social time.
I couldn't quite tell how serious you were being. You were sort of saying about the idea of being less civilised as things went on, or when combat fatigue.
Yes.
Yes, I just can. It's slightly chronologically out of place, but since you brought it up, I mean, was there a sense that after a year or so that, you know, the way that you were responding to the situation changed?
Yes. The confrontation went on for 4 years. Mm. And we were there on 3-year tours. I actually, because 215 Squadron was a new squadron, we all went out together we had to come back at staggered intervals. So people started going back from Singapore after 2 years, and the last ones left after 3 years. I left after 2.5. And by the time it got to 2 years, the constant round of flying and drinking and flying and drinking and flying and drinking became fatiguing. And when the lot of the flying was through tropical storms and or Indonesian ground fire and or the mountains of Borneo, or that you got all three together in Borneo, it was terrifying. I found it terrifying, and anybody who didn't find it terrifying, I reckon, didn't have any imagination. And the supply dropping became, because the Argus's, all the airplanes had serviceability problems, it was a very harsh environment for airframes and instruments and engines. So we had increasing serviceability problems, which meant that we had to fly at all hours of the day and night to carry out the task. And at a high intensity in Borneo, we found that we were doing more detachments to Borneo. And, uncivilized is the way of speaking. We used to run riot in the evenings. When we were out in Borneo, we shared a mess with the sergeants. Well, we didn't share it, but we used to get together in each other's messes. New Zealanders were pretty terrifying in their way of relaxing.
Why was that?
I'm not sure, but they were stupendously uncivilized. There's one guy who had the nickname Sebastian Q. Dangerfield. I don't know whether you ever read a book called The Ginger Man. It was popular at the time, and this guy was, and Sebastian Q. Dangerfield was a rip-roaring sort of a guy, and so that's why this man got this reputation. I don't know why the New Zealanders were, but they were always outside the law. And so, yes, we got more and more uncivilized. And it all started, I think. I mean, the deep end was, for me, 4 weeks after arriving in Changi, we had to go and evacuate the embassy in
Jakarta.
And this was the start of the terrifying. And do you want to know about that now?
Yeah, definitely.
It was... the confrontation had been boiling since November the year before, 1972, when there was the Brunei Rebellion. And that's another story in itself. And if you want to read about it, you can read about it in my book. And we weren't there then, but that was when the Indonesians stirred up a revolt in Brunei, which is an oil-rich state out in Borneo. It didn't join Malaysia in the end because the Sultan of Brunei wanted to protect his oil revenues and didn't want it going to some larger arrangement. But that's where the Indonesians first had a revolt. There was a revolt inspired by the Indonesians, a nationalist army that wanted to throw off the despotic rule of the Sultan and the British with it, because it was a British protectorate. And so it was a proper cause for foment. That was put down by the British and others. But it's the foment continued. And then in September 1973, Malaysia, the Federation of Malaysia, came into existence. And that caused riots in Jakarta, which was the Indonesian capital. The President Sukarno declared that they would crush Malaysia and fostered this foment. It was led by students, but it was encouraged by the police and others. Police did nothing to stop it. they sacked, before they sacked the British Embassy, they dug up the cricket pitch, which sounds a bit sort of folksy, but that was their way of telling the British that and other that they better get out. So it was decided that the embassy had to be evacuated and all the British nationals with it. It was a Saturday and I was called from the bar, I remember rightly, of the officers' mess to the squadron. There were to be three Arguses and a Hastings who were going to fly down that afternoon to Jakarta. We went for briefing and we were told that we'd been given right of passage down the Indonesian Airways, but we weren't to leave the airways and we should look out for trouble. Be aware that there were MiG fighters on bases not far away, that the Indonesians had complete air superiority and that they had anti-aircraft guns which would be pointing at us. So we had the airplanes rigged in passenger rig, which meant that we had seats. Our airplanes had quite nice blue canvas seats for I think they were upholstered actually for passengers, and the quartermasters stocked up with as much as they could in the way of food and victuals and water and drinks and coffee, and off we set. We flew straight into Indonesia, of course, 16 miles across the straits. So I was having to, and Scotty Leary was a pilot, normal crew, and Rev Wilkins was the navigator, flight lieutenant off Shackleton's. And he, of course, was responsible for navigating us down the airways, but I did all the radio calls. We flew straight into the biggest Sumatra I've ever been in. The weather was absolutely appalling. It was November, so the monsoon was cracking, was breaking. We didn't see the ground. We flew for 2.5 hours through cloud down the spine of Indonesia, which is mountainous, so it was hugely turbulent. Fortunately, the navigation was straightforward because Philips, when the Dutch left, the firm Philips had left a very good system of beacons and radio. So the radio communication was good, and we flew. We were able to keep on the airway. But we couldn't fly to get out of these bloody storms. We could see them on the cloud and collision warning radar, but there was nothing we could do. I really thought the airplane was going to blow up, break to pieces. Water was streaming in everywhere. You can't keep that sort of rain out of the airplane. It was running down the windscreens, inside as well as out. The lightning was flashing. It was hell on wheels. We crossed the equator, but we didn't realize. Nothing could be done to celebrate it. It was my first time south of the equator, because the equator is just south of Singapore. But oh boy, it was terrifying. But we finally did get to Jakarta. We could see it as we arrived. There was a break in the storm, thank goodness. We landed in floods of water. We aquaplaned down the runway. You deal with that by pumping the brakes. If you put the brakes on and they lock, you know you're aquaplaning. They've got a device on them, anti-lock brakes, so they can unlock the brakes on our aeroplane. The Hastings, I don't think, had that. And the Hastings arrived after us and had some difficulty keeping on the runway. It was so wet. It was so wet. We were parked, the Arguses and the Hastings, well away from any terminal buildings. We were parked right out in the on the edge of the airfield, but the captain the wing commander was flying one of the airplanes. He was the senior man, and he had to find his way to the terminal in a torrential downpour to find out what was going on. We sat there for some time, and darkness was falling when we saw a string of bedraggled Brits making their way on foot across to the airplane, led by... Now, this was another thing which had annoyed the students, was that whilst they were wanting to burn down the embassy, Major Muir from the Black Watch marched up and down playing his bagpipes in full Highland gear, which incensed the crowds. Well, he was leading this procession. May have incensed the crowds, but it gave leadership to this straggling line of men, women and children who had been turned out of their homes and had to... I'm sorry, it's affecting me. But it was a very affecting occasion.
We can stop for a minute if you like.
That's all right. And there were about 120 of them marching through the rain to these aeroplanes. And we got them on board. They were obviously themselves extremely distressed, but they must have found the RAF uniforms and the RAF aeroplanes
Quite discomforting.
It was all discomforting. They must have found that comforting. Mm. We got them on the aeroplanes and sat them down. There weren't enough seats for everybody, so the children sat in the gangways. And we... And all this time, I should have mentioned, all this time, we'd been guarded by the Indonesian army. But they pointed their rifles at us. Not outside. So it was a fairly tense time. But we got them on board. The soldiers let us go. We got permission to take off. And we took off back into these bloody storms and flew for another 3 hours. I think it took 3 hours on the way back to Changi. The people that had to leave everything behind except what they could carry. They'd left some people behind too. Well, not everybody was there. A headcount check showed that though we were short of people, so I had to make a call to ops in Changi to say there needs to be a further flight the next morning. We bumped and bumped. The quartermasters fed them cups of soup and coffee and tea and something to eat. And some of them fell asleep. But they were obviously in a state of shock, these poor people. And when we got them back to Changi, they were taken in hand by the welfare people and the British Embassy in Changi, of course. And we said goodbye to them. Very moving experience. Frightening experience because of the weather and because of the Indonesians and all the rest of it. But a moving experience because I've not seen anything like it before or again. And we realised that confrontation was on and real, and it was into battle. Sure. There we are.
We can stop there.